Welcome to World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM and the program A Chat with the Dean with your host, Dean of Faculty here at Maharshi University of Management, Dr. Kathy Guarini, whose guest today is Dr. David Orm Johnson, who was the former chair and founder of the psychology department here at Maharshi University of Management. Dr. David Orm Johnson has been a leading researcher on the TM and TM Cities program for many years. And Dr. Greeny, I can't think of many people, academic or otherwise, who has contributed to the great body of knowledge that people turn to when researching the Maharshi's TM programs.
That's absolutely correct, Stan. And Dr. Orm Johnson has done so many critical or groundbreaking studies showing the benefits of transcendental meditation and the TM City program. And for many years, you were an active researcher hooking people up to the EEG machine and analyzing the data and so on. And I understand that you haven't been doing that, doing these hands-on experiments, but yet you are very, very productive. And so my question is, how can a scientist be continuing to do research and producing papers when they're not right there in the lab hooking people up and measuring things?
Well, the answer is that the 600 or 700 studies on transcendental meditation is like this ocean of information to be consolidated and summarized, and so that's what I've been doing. Maharshi always wanted me to have the broad view of the research, and so what I've been doing is what's called a meta-analysis. It's a mathematical technique to combine all the research in different areas, like on anxiety is one of the papers that I just had accepted for publication, and see what kind of conclusions you can draw from all the research that's been done. And as new research comes along, then that's just more fodder for my activities.
So one thing I've noticed over time is that, you know, maybe there was more research on recidivism at one point of time, and then college students and so on. Do you see any trends? Does it seem like people go into an area and find results and then leave it? It would seem to me they would want to keep going more deeply.
There has been a vertical direction to the research. The most exciting research that's going on right now, I think, is on epigenetics, which is taking the research down to the molecular, to the DNA level. And some of the research happening here at MUM and Dr. John Fagan's laboratory has shown that TM changes how certain genes are expressed and certain chromosomes are expressed. And so this gives a molecular explanation for some of the benefits that we saw in the early research and which has been developing along the way. And so another level is of course, a physiological explanation. One of the big developments that's happened over the 40 years, last 40 years, is the understanding of the relevance of EEG coherence for the functional organization of the brain. EEG coherence is now thought of as being like the kind of the conductor that coordinates the activities of the different parts of the brain. The brain is a distributed system, and so when we want to do something, it's not like there's a single area in your brain that's concerned with a particular activity. It puts together all these different things and different areas that have different specific functions into a pattern. That's happening all the time and changing as we do different things. But the EEG coherence is orchestrating that.
Now, that's very interesting, because I remember the very first studies of EEG coherence, people were like, well, what's the big deal?
Right.
And I know, was it Maharshi that really emphasized EEG coherence, or was that something other people had been studying?
Well, people had been studying it for years, but there was not much on coherence, actually. And generally, the feeling about EEG was that it didn't seem to show much. It was thought of as like putting a stethoscope up to a television set, which has all these wires and all this very intricate functions are going on, very delicate functions, and you're just hearing the overall random noise. So a lot of people thought that, and still do, that are kind of not up to date on what's happening, thought that, EEG doesn't really have anything relevant to say, that or a relationship with behavior and thinking. So what happened was, as far as TM goes, Marcia was very interested in hearing about the latest EEG or scientific studies on TM. These were the glory days for the scientists, where we got to sit around with Keith Wallace and all of us and talk to Marcia about the research. So we were all hearing in a meeting about some new EEG studies that were done by Jean-Paul Basquet in France. And he mentioned that he saw one of the things he saw was a synchrony across the brain. Didn't mention the word coherence, but the measure is very similar. Marcy suddenly lit up because it fit beautifully with the whole explanation of the quantum mechanical level of nature, that nature at its basis is really a very coherent, and that the diversity that you see on the surface level, which is not always coherent, is actually made up of coherent processes. And this is the fundamental level of natural law. And Marcy felt something very fundamental, was happening. So, for example, when we wrote the catalog for MIU, sort of the master plan, some of the faculty got to sit around with Marcy and plan the sort of ideal university.
That was in
1972. And it was Larry Domash, physicist, and Marcy saying all these glorious things about EEG coherence or synchrony between left and right brain, and this is going to bring together analytic and spatial type thought. And the physiologists who knew the field at the time were kind of cringing, it really sounds really good, but there's not a whole lot of evidence yet, that shows that. And so we started doing these very simple experiments where we would look at the relationship between how coherent a person's brain was and how creative they were. That was like the first study that I was involved in. And there was a high correlation. And I think all the meditators or TM teachers have seen the chart that shows EEG coherence in the center. And as John Hagelin says, everything good is related to it. But it's not just our research has shown that. We were some of the first ones, but now there's hundreds of studies out there. In fact, we just did a literature review of EEG coherence in the year 2013, and it came up with about 40 papers,
wow,
all showing the same theme, that during memory processes, these various areas, if they were coherent and in the alpha range, which is what happens during TM, then there's that connection is made and the whole thing works, and when they're incoherent, they forget, and it's the concept's not formed, and so forth. So it was Marashi that put attention on it,
yeah.
And it's like that in other fields too. Marashi started talking about the unified field actually early on. He talks about it in The Science of Being and The Art of Living. I think it was 1969 that came out, and now that's, as John Hagelin says, and I have a nephew who's into this, that's all they're studying, basically. It's the unified field theory. So it's like he put attention on it, and suddenly it got lively in the collective consciousness of the scientific world.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've seen that meditators, or you've seen, and we've seen it in the results, that meditators have higher coherence and then higher creativity is correlated with that.
Right.
Have these recent studies that you've looked at, do they propose any way of making brain waves more coherent, or are they just studying how people with more coherent brain waves have some other attributes?
A lot of them are in the context of a clinical setting where they take a clinical group like schizophrenics, and their cognitive processes are working in a very unusual way, and showing that their coherence patterns are unusual, or they're incoherent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, or if they're brain damaged or something, it's not coherent. Or you fall asleep, the frontal executive parts of the brain become incoherent. It's one of the first things you see when a person's drowsy, and behaviorally, you're tripping and dropping and not getting it. And so it all fits together into this very coherent picture.
Now, I want to go back to something you said earlier, because this fascinates me about this epigenomics. And You know, we, as meditators, we experience what happens during meditation, and then we experience the benefits. And, you know, because we've heard about the research and because we've heard Maharshi's explanations, it kind of makes sense. But why, and I want to hear what you have to say about this, why when you're meditating, and we know what that experience is like, why on earth would that have anything to do with the genes in each individual cell?
Well, it's because how the genes are expressed depends on their environment. So if you have a rose, say, cutting or something bush, and you plant it in the shade, and it's kind of soggy, and it's not getting enough sunlight, you'll get a weedy little plant. And you put the same genetic material, the same plant, on the sunny side, and it's well watered, and has lots of sunlight, then you'll get this magnificent expression of its genetic potential. It'll be a beautiful rose plant. So what's the environment of the genes in all the cells? It's the body chemistry. So if you're going to saturate it with stress hormones and all these imbalances, you're going to get one kind of genetic expression. And if you have a very balanced physiology, very nourishing physiology, you'll get a whole different genetic expression. And so TM is changing the environment in which the genes exist, in which they're being expressed. That's how I understand it. There may be other
mechanisms. No, that makes a lot of sense. And so so at some point, then, they're going to have to study the hormones and the blood chemistry.
We have been. And so you have to find the connections between all these different things. You know, if your cortisol is chronically high, how does that express, or how does that affect the expression of certain genes? And there may be research out there on that. It's really exciting now because all these different pieces are being studied individually. There are sets of scientists out there studying, I'm sure they're out there studying things like cortisol's effects on gene regulation or something like that, or various hormones effects. And it's just to put it all together into a picture, you know. And that's sort of what I'm doing with right now with the collected papers. And yeah, I mean, learn all kinds of new areas. But get the experts into it.
I guess a lot of this has to do with the environment, you say. So Maharshi's emphasis on health and what we eat and what we surround ourselves with and what kind of education we get, all of this is factored in.
Right, exactly right. And the world is as we are. So what the environment is to us has a lot to do with what we are and how flexible we are in adapting to the environment. One person's stressful situation is another person's opportunity to do something really good, to create it.
So, you know, this fascinates me that you're doing all these meta-analyses. Could you tell us about some of them? Because I know there's many different ones. For example, comparing research done by meditators to non-meditators, or just whatever new things are happening.
Well, one of the disturbing things of the anti-TM information that you can find on the internet is that all the research is done by the meditators, and therefore it's positive. And research by non-meditators, you know, doesn't find the same stuff. So that as part of what I've been studying, I've looked at that question. So, for example, I just had two papers accepted for publication in very good journals, and one was on anxiety. And one of the things I did was that, in fact, both of these papers, I did the same thing. I looked at the effect size, which is a measure of how big the effect is. For example, with blood pressure, an effect size would be how much your blood pressure decreases. But there's other measures of it, which are more obscure and hard to explain, which I won't explain right now.
But they depend on the experiments that were done.
Yeah, yeah. So the question is, do studies that originated from researchers who were at MUM or MIU, going back to the 70s, do they have bigger effect sizes than research is done by outsiders? And the answer is no. In every case that I looked at it, there was actually a slightly smaller effect size for the people from MIU or MUM. And so, but then the question comes, how do you define, you know, being being from MUM. For example, you might have a study in anxiety by Michael Dilbeck, who was at Purdue. Well, the first way I did it, I counted him, obviously, as being from MUM. Anybody who was ever, you know, either did the research prior to being with MIU or after or during, I counted that as an MUM, or even if we knew that they were meditators or not. And any way you defined it, it still came out that everybody was being honest. You got the usual range of kinds of results, depending on the kinds of populations that are being studied. And the results from MUM were not any stronger than the results from outsiders. Well, you might ask, well, who's an outsider who would even be interested in studying transcendental meditation? You know, that's a good question, because most of the research truly is by people who are interested and who practice it themselves, and that's true of any meditation technique or any relaxation technique. You only study things that you think might have some value and might work, and so we're no different from anyone else, yet it's still a valid question. Well, one category of researchers who've done research on TM who are not TMers are people who do other meditation techniques. For example, Dr. Mohammed Shafi, who's did some great two great studies on TM and marijuana use and alcohol use in the 70s, and he's an MD and published in a very good journal. He's a Sufi meditator, so he feels that meditation is a good thing, but he doesn't feel, you know, that this is like a standardized kind of technique that anyone can do. And so, you know, he did his research on TM. And another one was Ken Pelletier, who was at Stanford University, did a really good study on field independence in the 1970s. And one of the meta-analyses I was doing, his effect size was the largest effect size of any of the studies. So I had communicated with him in the 70s. I didn't know if he was a meditator or not. He certainly was not at MUM or MIU or anything. So I sent him an email, and I located him, and I asked him, were you ever a TMer, or did you practice TM at that time, or do you practice it now, or any time? He said, no, he never did. He said he does some other technique, and he just thought it was really interesting to study. Huh. Then another class of people who do research on TM or not TMers are doctors, and who are just, it's one of the things that's around, and they're studying different relaxation techniques, and they add that one in. And then there are those who want to disprove TM. And when you look at their studies, it's an interesting thing. Some of the papers that are touted out there as proving that TM doesn't work, what they've shown is not that it doesn't work. If you compared what happens during TM with anxiety on one of them, with treatment as usual, it has a very strong effect. But they found some other technique which had an equal effect or about the same effect. So there are other things out there that will reduce anxiety, you know, progressive muscle relaxation. Overall, it doesn't seem to be as good, but there are some studies that show that it is, that it reduces anxiety just as much as TM does. So they didn't show that TM doesn't work. What they did show was something else did work.
But in that specific area. And, of course, that's one of the wonderful things about TM is the range of benefits.
And the other, yes, and that's related to the issue of cross-validation. Is something like anxiety is a very subjective measure. And with the TM research, what we find is that the physiology of TM is just the opposite of what anxiety produces. So you have a physiological validation, which validates what the person is saying psychologically. His cortisol is becoming less when they meditate. You know, heart rate's decreasing, respiration rate is decreasing. All those things go up with anxiety. So you have all these different levels. And then anxiety-associated behaviors like drug and alcohol consumption and a lot of other problems are related to anxiety. People are self-medicating, trying to reduce their anxiety. So the fact that these anxiety-promoted behaviors are reducing is a behavioral validation that TM is really significantly reducing anxiety. It's not just psychological. I'm trying to make the researcher feel good because he seems to be a nice guy, and so I want him to his study to work out, so I'm going to say I'm less anxious. He's also, his blood pressure is decreasing, and he's living longer. So.
In the movement, Marsh's movement, seems to be the standard whether or not meditation is working. Are you transcending? Do these other people, do they also measure that as a standard of whether or not the meditation is working, if there's transcendence?
No, you know, so far in the meditation literature, and there's now a huge interest in it, transcending is just now beginning to be discussed. Not transcending, but the concept of pure consciousness, because it's in the Yoga Sutras, and these people are beginning to read all of that. But no one but us has actually measured, physiologically measured, what happens when you transcend. You know, where the person after they transcended pushed a button, you look back, you say, oh, the breath stopped during that time, the brain got more coherent, number of changes, the autonomic nervous system settled down. So we're the only ones who've done research like that. Now, one of the uniqueness of TM, unique things about TM is you're not practicing anything in particular. So one of the studies, you know, you're just meditating. You're not practicing, for example, pistol shooting. Well, one of the studies that's out there is being advertised by some people as being showing that TM does not work. And, you know, this is objective research showing TM doesn't work. It was on pistol shooting, and overall.
I was wondering why you used that as an example,
yeah.
That we don't practice.
We don't practice pistol shooting. Well, we don't practice it. Well, the study showed, it was very interesting, they had three conditions, rapid fire, slow fire, and timed fire. And overall, TM wasn't better than the standard curriculum that they were involved in. These were students who were taking a course on pistol shooting. And TM didn't improve overall. But if you look at the details, what you found is it didn't change. They didn't get any better than standard training on slow fire or time fire, but they did on rapid fire. And I thought that was really interesting, because one of the things I'm finding in my exploration of the collected papers on the cognitive variables is that where TM really has big effects compared to the control group is that when there's some kind of complexity or some kind of spontaneity. So rapid fire, you don't have, it's not a control thing. It's spontaneous behavior, and it really fits into the whole theme of spontaneous right action.
That is fascinating.
So, yeah,
so but what was this study even trying to do?
It was in the 70s, and people were wondering, well, maybe relaxation would help people shoot better, you know. The thing that the study showed worked the best was they had a kind of a special training where you actually practice all of the perceptual and motor behaviors. You're practicing that specific thing. So there are studies, like TM, you're not practicing a specific thing.
Right.
You know, so if you're gonna compare TM, if your measure is shooting basketballs through a hoop, and one group just meditates, and the other practices shooting basketballs through a hoop, they might do better. They probably will. But duh.
Yeah. But then, of course, it might be interesting to see a third group who is learning how to get hoops or basketballs through a hoop and is also practicing transcendental meditation.
Yeah, generally it speeds up your progress, whatever you're trying to do, whatever you're training in, whatever you're trying to learn, whatever you're trying to do. It provides a sort of general integration. And I think during meditation, a lot of what you've been practicing gets consolidated in the memory. And so it generally what's been found is that it does speed you up in learning.
Now, so you've done a lot of studies yourself, and you've done these meta studies. And I'm curious if you could choose to do any experiment or series of experiments right now. No question of funding or subjects or anything. What sorts of things would you do? I mean, what kind of questions do you have that you feel like haven't been answered by the study so far?
Actually, I'm doing that. I'm sitting in the dome with my eyes closed on the Invincible America course, because the most significant research that's happening, of course, is on the level of consciousness, because the instrument is the nervous system studying what's happening to itself. You know, when you're transcending and when you're doing long meditations and you're beginning in with a group that's doing it, and you begin to really have amazing experiences. So I've been doing that. I've been on the IA all summer.
Yeah,
and we've done that 4 years in a row. And I've just been experiencing increasing bliss, and you know, during program, just huge. You know, especially during flying, it's my favorite sort of place to be during the day. It's flying. And in activity, it's amazing. You know, I've often had the thought that of all the research and charts and hundreds of studies, there's no chart or study on the most important thing that happens with TM, which is it improves your enjoyment of life. Mm-hmm. And we experience that, everybody, you know, meditators. From the very beginning, I remember back in El Paso when we learned TM in 1970, and Rhode and I became TM junkies. We'd go hear the lectures again, and we'd, you know, and advanced lectures or whatever. We weren't teachers. And it was always after a lecture or something, there was such joy of being together that the group wouldn't split up. And then we'd all go to Baskin Robbins, we'd eat ice cream, and we'd be laughing and enjoying. And so that's the greatest result, you know, walking home from the dome. You know, I pull out my iPhone and I see the, you know, the galaxies of Queensland's lace and all these things and the birds. And the greatest thing for me is music, listening to music, because I just close my eyes and I think I'm probably falling asleep. I'm not. I, you know, get down on that silent level and it's like I see it coming out of you know, out of the silence, out of the transcendent. And just so amazing, you know, just the beauty of it and everything. And so that's what I've been doing. That's where the research should go and is going.
Well, that's really the fulfillment of scientific research. You know, it's like the whole idea behind scientific research is to gain knowledge, and a specific study gains one isolated fragment of knowledge, but it's really in consciousness that there's the wholeness and totality of knowledge.
Yeah, the other day after flying, I lay down and I just experienced my body as being transparent. Inside, nothing in it, you know. I just, the skin is like a shell. It's like Marshy's analogy of the bunion seed. And then I asked myself, it has some, what is this empty, this space? And then it had some quality. I'm thinking, what is this quality? Is it kind of like gelatin or something? No, it's not that concrete. What is this quality of it? Is it air? No, air is too kind of inert. It was bliss. It was like a full coming around. Marcy said, you know, the sap, the color, what would you call it? The colorless sap. There it is, the colorless sap. And I'm thinking, but you know, the body is filled with all these guts, bones, and cells, and tissue systems. So how do you reconcile that view of it with what you're experiencing? And of course, it came around again to the simplest explanation. The overall effect of all the things that are happening in physiology, the brain's really important, but all the other things that are supporting it, is consciousness. And as our consciousness changes, our experience changes. And this is true for, you know, every human being, every moment of their life, and all the bugs and insects and animals. They have these little physiological systems. What it's doing is it's creating a localized consciousness, depending on their physiology and its structure and its you know, level of development. So that's what we're doing. That's where the research is going.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And as a side benefit, we're going to calm down the world and they're not going to bomb Syria.
That's very important. We have more worthy things to do, like painting. And this is an end result. It's a goal of yours that has come to pass. And how is your painting coming?
Well, really, no, I wouldn't mind to say I really like my own paintings. They're getting better. And there's a lot of fabulous artists in town. It's just amazing. I went to the Friday Art Walk last night, and it was just like everybody's getting better. It's just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
Charlotte Kane's show at Icon Gallery is just really wonderful.
Well, that's true, and I think that's generally the direction that we are going in, is more enjoyment in life. Marcy always said that the life is to be enjoyed. Yeah. Did you happen to hear Marcy's talk on art and music?
Maybe.
In which he said,
yeah,
there's no difference. Art and music are the same thing. I'll have to,
okay.
I'll send you that.
Play it on the radio.
Yeah, wonderful. Yes, Rhoda just, by the way, went on to YouTube.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. She taped. She made three tapes, 15-minute tapes, with Anita Travis doing all the video work on Marshy's, on her book, Marshy Talking About Language and Literature. So you have the book summarized, and if you just go on YouTube and Google or look for Rhoda Arm Johnson, you'll come up with these 15-minute tapes where she's talking about different aspects of what Marshy has said about literature and language, where she's illustrated it with beautiful poems and things from literature. And then she made three in French, which are going to come out soon, and then she made a seventh one, which is on her own poetry.
Nice.
Rhoda's gone out to the world.
She certainly has, and I think her next publication will be on art, is that right? Art and music?
What? Her book?
Isn't she going to be writing on what Marshy has said about music and art?
Someone else will. There's another book coming out on art. Rhoda's book with Susan Anderson is called The Flow of Consciousness, Marshy O'Dea on Literature and Language, and that's in the bookstore. And so that was published a couple of years ago, but the next one coming down the line is on art.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's going to be one on music and hopefully on all different areas, because Marshy talked about all different areas.
Well, this is a kind of interview I enjoy, because when you end up in art and music, it's just joy.
The fulfillment of science really is a fulfilled, blissful, creative human being. It's not somebody in a white coat. It's
In the science
fullness
itself, to tell the truth, I get more fun sometimes out of making these scientific discoveries than we hardly talked about them. at least as much fun as doing the art. And one thing I can mention is that these two papers that got accepted recently.
The anxiety ones?
Yeah, and one was on anxiety, and one was a comment on a meta-analysis on meditation techniques, which was in Psychological Bulletin by a group from Germany. Anyway, the comments from the reviewers were very positive, you know, like one of them says, all in all, I'm very impressed with the quality of this paper. It was a pleasure to read. You know, this is not usually what you get back from reviewers. And, another one said, in summary, I appreciated the very detailed and thought-provoking analysis completed by the current authors. I see promise in the subsequent manuscripts to expand the work of Settlemyer and hope that the authors themselves might consider embarking on such a project. Well, we've been embarking on it about 40 years.
But it's great to see that the reviewers are starting to be more positive. I remember in the old days they used to demand redoing of the statistics ad infinitum, and kept getting better and better results, right?
Well, yeah, and they still do. The first paper on anxiety only had some minor revisions. One of the things I found there is that the degree that anxiety decreases through TM depends on how anxious you are to begin with. So if you're not anxious, it's not going to decrease. Again, it's kind of duh, but I had to go through some really sophisticated mathematics to make that point, called meta-regression, but just show that, you know, if you take the level of the anxiety to begin with, you don't see much change. But if you take people with PTSD or anxiety patients that are, you know, seeing psychiatrists for that, or prison inmates or prison guards, they have very elevated anxiety, and you get very rapid and large decreases right away with those populations. So that was one of the things. So,
well, thank you, Dr. Kathy Greeny and Dr. David Orm Johnson, for this very lively and relevant discussion that points to how valuable the research on Marshy's TM and TM Cities program is to solving everybody's program and enjoyment in the end. So thank you for joining us, our KHOE listening audience, and we say Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev.